Good evening once again, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time, and I'm William Cooper. Today we continue with our lecture series from our conference in 1998 at the Thunder Horse Ranch. Today's lecture will begin a series of broadcasts that we are going to do on a lecture presented by Mr. Jay Reynolds, a farmer from Arkansas, who told us about crops and how to raise them and fertilize them and store them and all of this kind of stuff. If you're interested in gardening, or if you're a farmer, or if you're interested in farming or gardening or raising any kind of plants, especially those used to sustain a family through nutritional or medicinal means, then you need to listen to this and you need to take notes. And if you just want to hear from some information from a real good man and a personal friend of mine who has been a member of our organization for many years, he is not just a farmer. He's one of the most intelligent men that I know. He does a tremendous amount of research and helps us put together the documented and sourced information that we use in Veritas, on the Hour of the Time, and then on our webpage, on the internet, and many other places, and through many other mediums. So, without any further ado, here is Mr. Jay Reynolds, and I hope you enjoy this as much as I did.
Well, when y'all, as I'm talking today, if you got any questions, don't hesitate. That helped me fill up the time. I've always had the idea of being self-sufficient. I really liked it. And I think Michael covered that too, about how that's part of freedom, is being able to take care of yourself. So, as a child, my grandfather grew a really neat garden. He was in South Arkansas, and he was composting 50 years ago. A lot of people just kind of started it, or I came back, because originally, when there weren't any chemicals or fertilizers, people had draft animals and barnyards, and they would pile stuff up when it got too big and it turned into compost, and they had to put it somewhere. So I'm sure they figured out it made the garden grow. So, but he was ahead of his time on that, I think. He did a lot of things that people consider new nowadays. He used mulch. He made compost. He had cold frames. And I know he was doing that 50 years ago because I could see how he had set it up, and he died in the mid-70s, but I inherited some of his books. I've got some of his original books where he wrote things down. Of course, you can tell the book's pretty old because they talk about DDT and all that stuff too. But so when I started doing a little extra research for the conference, I started thinking about, well, there's a lot of different scenarios I could talk about. You could say, well, how do you grow a garden under enemy fire? But what I'll talk about today is a scenario where it's possible to be on your own and grow what you want. That we don't know how that might work out, but it's basically self-sufficient gardening or farming. The idea of farming is more large scale than what I'm going to talk about, but you could expand the ideas as big as you wanted. Just generally, farming is more of a large scale idea. But what I thought about is what we need every day and what we need long term to eat. And the paper I'll pass you out first is probably the basics, that some of the things you really can't do without any one food or else you're going to starve. I did look up starvation and what is starvation and what is malnourishment and what is undernourishment, and the relief agencies have some information on it. And basically what it is, you may probably know, have an idea about this, which is your carbohydrates are what give you energy every day. Your proteins are what build tissue and body, muscle. And fats, they contain some of the carbohydrates too. In fact, our Western diet is high in fats. Up to 40% of some people's carbohydrates come from fats, and some from sugar too. But in starvation, generally, you will have a low input of all things. If you have a low input on just one thing, you can still starve. Even if you have, for instance, if you have lots of carbohydrates and very little protein, you'll have a quashed short, they call it. The belly will get big. You've probably seen this, especially in children. And if you don't have enough carbohydrates, you'll not have energy. What will happen, first of all, is your body will work on its reserves of fat. And for some of us, that's probably not a bad idea. But over the long term, if when that fat's exhausted, the body will work on muscle, and you'll lose muscles, become very weak. And at the very terminal end of starvation, the last reserves that the body has will be the bone marrow. And you may live laying down, and that will be the last reserves. There's another component, though, of starvation. It makes you much more susceptible to disease and sickness. So what I did, I went to some references and looked up the highest sources of protein, carbohydrates, and fats that we could grow here in the U.S. Of course, it depends on your climate, depends on your location. Somebody in Florida could grow things that someone in Maine couldn't grow. There's other techniques to grow things out of season or out of climate, but the basic ones I put are something we almost all know about. Does everybody know what cowpeas are? That's black-eyed peas is one example. I think we all know the rest of them, though. And if you look at your protein sources, they usually will come from the seed of a plant. They're usually the highest in protein, and that's because that's the food reserve for the plant to start up again. So I looked at all the beans, which is one source of those, and the common grains that are easy to grow. There's other grains, but they have some problems. For instance, you can grow oats, but if you've ever fed horses oats, you'll see that that's a whole grain with a hard husk on the outside of it, and it's very hard to mill on a small scale without special equipment. You can grow oats real easy, though, and if you're going to feed animals, that might be a good choice. But I found so far that wheat and corn are the easiest to handle. Corn is by far the easiest. You can just wring those off with your hands or some little equipment. Wheat is a little harder, but if you look at it, I've got cornmeal and wheat here. The wheat is much higher in proteins. And let's see, your carbohydrates are pretty comparable. Fats pretty comparable, but the protein is much higher in wheat, so if you can grow wheat, and most places can grow wheat, that's probably one of your best choices. It stores real good. And we're all used to eating bread and other things. So what I'm doing here is giving you choices and giving you an idea of what's available. What you'd have to make your own choices. For me, cowpeas, I live in Arkansas in the south. Cowpeas are a really good choice. They grow quick. Cowpeas are probably a 60 to 70 day crop, whereas wheat is in the ground for a long time. The other beans are probably pretty close to cowpeas, but I can get two crops or maybe three of those in a year, in a season. One thing, as far as proteins go, there's different elements that are in within the family that we call proteins, and it's best to get a whole range of these. You need all of them, really. So what you'll find in one bean or one grain won't necessarily be in another one. So as far as protein goes, it's best to mix things. That's why in the Southwest you'll see corn and beans together. In the Orient, you'll see soybeans and rice together, or fish and rice, or a combination. That's known as complementary proteins. And there's some good books on that. But that's what you need to look for, the combination. Any one of these would probably not make it. You wouldn't make it good on any of just one of them. It's always good anyway if you're growing things to not rely on just one crop, because you might have one insect that wipes one out. You can always do another one. And along in here, I put potatoes and sweet potatoes. As you look, they have low proteins, and they're not as high quality as others, but they're a good source of carbohydrates. And they also happen to have some vitamins. I've got another page coming up that will show you that they contain some vitamins that grains and beans don't contain. So they're kind of dual purpose. You get both vitamins, some significant ones, and also your protein, carbohydrates too. If I was going to choose beans, though, I would take a close look at soybeans in the upper right, because if you look, they beat all the others in protein. And if you look down at the bottom, I have on here that they contain all three, but then they also contain a complete protein, which you can't get with any of the other crops on here. So soybeans are pretty neat. Now, soybeans come in different varieties. There's some that are grown specially for oil. There's some that are grown specially for soy milk. And there's some that are, those are generally not that good to eat by themselves, just like you would kidney beans. So if you're going to grow soybeans to eat for yourself and just boil and cook, you need to find what's called an edible soybean. And they're not always easy to find. You'll have to look in several seed catalogs. Some that I know of that you can find it in is the Vermont Bean Seed Company. And they have almost more beans than any other company I've seen. And they've got two. They've got a yellow and a black. I've never tried the black or the yellow.
Do you have a phone number on there?
No, I don't. But they do have an 800 number.
What state is it?
Vermont. Yeah, they're called Vermont Seed Company, but I believe they've been bought out. Most of the smaller seed companies, even the garden seed companies, are being bought out and conglomerated. And luckily, most of the grain, the dry type beans, almost all of them are open pollinated. In other words, they're not hybrid. Your green beans, a lot of those are hybrid, but your other beans, almost every one of them are open pollinated or non-hybrid seeds. So they stay real good. Beans are a no-brainer for saving seeds. We all know how to do that. That's part of the process.
Are you going to cover today and talk about the necessity of acquiring open pollinated seeds for all of the different vegetables and where to get them?
Yeah, I've got a whole page on that.
Good.
I'm only giving out a page at a time because that's less distracting.
It might be a no-brainer, but I've never grown hard beans.
Okay, well, here's some advice. You grow them to their limit, they'll actually dry up. The whole plant will dry up, and you can at that time you can pull them up. One idea is to pull up a plant. You would get a 50-gallon barrel or a large trash can. A barrel works better. Take that whole plant in your hand and beat it on the inside of the barrel, and they'll just shatter and fall down in there. You don't want to leave them too long after they're dried, though, because say you got a rains, it would tend to mold the seeds. You want to kind of catch it just the right time when they mature.
So they should be real hard, right?
Oh, yeah, they'll be completely hard. Usually the plant will come to the end of its life cycle, and that'll be it. Now, there's beans that are grown for green beans, and they're generally not good for seed. So what you'll have to do is kind of look at the catalogs. They'll describe which are good for which use. Look at the length of time that it takes to bear. If you've got a long season, you can grow a long season. If you only have a short season, that's what you need to look for, is a quick crop. If at the end of that, you may still have some of the beans that don't come out of the pod, the next idea is to put them in a burlap bag or a flexible, large flexible bag and feed that too. And it's a threshing process to get those beans out of there. It's kind of fun. Eventually you'll end up with trash and stuff, and you'll have to sift through it. You can use to thresh grains and beans. It's kind of a fun process. I think it's neat. But you can use other things, screens, different sieves. For instance, I've grown wheat and taken it all the way to bread. Not in a big plot, probably about four times the size of this barn. Just enough to an experiment, really. And here's the way I do it. Your best high protein wheat is winter wheat. The other wheats that are available would be spring wheat and summer wheat. They're more for your lighter baked goods like cake flour or Well, that's one of the purposes. There's another one, durum wheat, which is for pasta making. You could probably make anything with any wheat, but some of them are a little more suited for one thing than the other. But the hard red winter wheat is probably the easiest one, and the neat thing about it is you plant it in the fall or late summer, depending on your season. And it grows a short height, maybe 4 or 5 inches, maybe more, and then it goes dormant for the whole winter. And it'll sit there. You can even graze cattle on it to an extent during the winter. Not too much, or else it'll be killed. But you can let that grow through the winter, then in the spring it'll come back to life and start to grow. And that's what you see. If any of you drove out here, you probably saw wheat fields all over. And what I do for harvesting, in my area there's nobody growing wheat commercially, so there's no threshing combines. And we might not have that available anyway. So what you'll need to do is when it dries, in order to tell when it's dry, the wheat will first enter the milk stage, which you can squeeze the grain and it'll be milky inside. Next, it'll get to the dough stage, which is where it is soft, but not milky anymore and not hard. The next stage is fully ripened. That's something you'd have to just get a feel for. If you harvest it and it's not ready, you're not going to get the use out of it. It's just probably, if it was milk, it would probably just shrivel up and be worthless. If it's not dry enough and you sort it with too much moisture, it's probably going to mold or rot. So what you need to do is get a feel for it. If somebody grows grain around you, you've got it made. But for me, I have a weed eater. You probably all know what a weed eater is. And it has a metal blade rather than a string. And I'll go down through the field cutting close to the ground and cutting that down when it's to the right stage, dried up. And after that, I put it on a big floor, concrete floor, and tromped on it, beat on it with sticks. In the old days, they used to run the horse or cattle around on it to loosen the grain. Then from there, you have to remove the stalks, which is the long stalks. And what will be left will be a combination of wheat and chaff. And the chaff is the protection for the kernel, the wheat kernels, as they mature. And you'll take that, and for me, it was the easiest to use an electric fan to winnow it. And that's a procedure you might have seen on TV, how the people in Afghanistan will toss it up in the wind. It's the same idea. The fan works great, really good. It's consistent. You can do it anytime you want, but you can do it in the wind. And at that stage, you're blowing away the chaff, and the weed is falling to the ground. It'll still be a little dirty, there'll be chaff. My land was sort of sandy, so there was still some sand in there. So the next stage was to use a chicken wire. You pour that on the chicken wire, it gets some of the straw off. The next stage was a little finer wire to get a little more of the stuff out. The next stage was just as big as the grain. A sifter just as big as the grain. Well, that's fine, except that doesn't get the sand out. So the final sifter has to be something that the sand can pass through, but the grain can't, like a window screen. And that will get the sand out. It's important, because you go eating that sand, it's hard on the teeth. So that's the way we did it. And you know, I meant to bring a sample out to show you just what it looks like. It's not perfect. What I'll have to do is, at the last, I sit down and listen to my shortwave radio and pick out the little pieces of chaff that just didn't get out. And probably before we make the bread, you'd probably put it out on the table and pick out any last little thing. So it's not as precise. You'd really be lucky if you could have a combine in the area to do it for you. But you can grow wheat. I think you can grow wheat anywhere. So corns, that's pretty self-explanatory. Peanuts. Anybody ever grown peanuts? You have? That's only one person grown peanuts.
Are they hard to grow?
No, they're not hard to grow. You don't necessarily have to have a certain soil, Bob. There's ways around soil. Now, a peanut is an unusual crop. Most people have no idea how it grows. It's a legume in the bean family, so that's why it has a high protein here, you see, too. Now, I didn't really realize it, but Michael was saying he's not very much in favor of peanuts. He thinks that a lot of people are allergic to it, but I know a lot of people eat peanuts, and I guess if you have the choice, better than nothing, right? So, for peanuts, you've all seen peanuts. They look like beans, and they are. But that bean doesn't grow in the air. It grows on the ground. Peanuts, generally, you plant them, they'll grow up, and then they'll start to flower. And that's where it gets real interesting. The flower will grow along the stem like any other, like most plants. But then, they will, after pollination, they will peg. And what you'll see is, you'll see an extension of the flower move down pretty fast, too. And when it hits the ground, it will keep growing into the ground. And that's where the peanut is formed underground. Not too deep, maybe maybe 4 inches at the most. I guess it depends on your soil.
It's grown dead there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're grown underground.
You said you didn't need a specific soil, David. I have to beg a difference on that. You certainly wouldn't want to grow peanuts in real place.
Adobe? Well, there's a way around it, though. And because I do have part of my garden in a sandy soil and part in a clay soil, what I do is when I plant my peanuts, I cover them with a mulch, which is sawdust. And that simulates a soft soil and allows the peanuts
to produce in the sawdust and not in the...
as much as anything. And you can improve clay soil too, though. So that's another answer. But that will help anything that has trouble either in seeding, for instance, in clay soil, it's difficult to get small seeds to come up. Sawdust is a choice. I sometimes plant right on top of the ground, and rather than cover with soil, I cover with sawdust. It allows the small seeds to push through real easy. But you can improve clay soil. You can improve clay soil. You can totally change the soil. In 5 years, when I started this garden, till now, the soil is probably 3/4 of the way to devil's food cake.
Sure. I saw that you're using. You're not talking about fresh sawdust, are you?
No, you can use fresh sawdust. But I'm using sawdust, which is from an oak mill, generally oak, but a little pine. It is true that some sawdust, especially when it's green, what you've got is a pure carbon, high carbon material. And when you put carbon on soil or wherever you put carbon, it will tend to want to rot. And in that process, it takes energy to reduce carbon, to rot carbon, and the energy that will be used will be nitrogen from the soil. So if you have a very green sawdust that has this ready to start that process, and you put sawdust on the ground, you can pull nitrogen from the soil for a while until that breaks down. It's worse if you till that sawdust in, it's worse. So the first year I tried that, I had a problem. My whole garden was yellow. And I had to add some fertilizer to it pretty quick or else we wouldn't have had anything. But it's a good source for mulch, sawdust is. It's fine, it's uniform. I'll be talking some more about mulch later, but if that kind of answers the question for now. So anyway, your peanuts, they're a fairly long crop. You have to figure at least 90 days to 100 days. I let my peanuts grow as long as I can till it frosts. It's probably the last thing that I pull out of the garden in the fall. How does that sound, Bull?
I was going to mention it takes a fairly long season.
Yeah. Do you know, can you add anything about peanuts since you've grown them before?
Not necessarily. They also make very good panels for the food.
Even the tops, probably, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You just pull the whole plant, store the same, and feed nuts and all into the cattle. But...
yeah. Well, I was talking about using oats for feed. I can buy wheat right now. So when I grew my wheat, I harvested enough to probably fill a 5 gallon bucket, which and threshed it down that far. The rest of it I baled up just like you would bale up hay and used for rabbit feed. They loved the stalk and the top and all. It was good food for them. By the way, if you want to know how to make your own hay bales, just fill a wooden box, put your baling wire or string down in the box, and start stomping as hard as you can and get it in there and then wrap it up. It looks just like any other hay bale. You can do it without any equipment at all. Just a wooden crate.
You put wheels on the box?
No.
You drag it in there?
No, I just took it out of the field and forked it, used a pitchfork and fork it in there. and lightweight. I can carry it. I can carry it with one hand.
Okay, I'll get what, 100 pounds or something?
No, you pull it out. Just pull it out of the box.
The bale gets about 100 pounds, though.
I use small. I bet it's small, because that's the neat thing. I have a small barn. I couldn't use big size bales. They probably wouldn't even fit it in the place that I had. So you can make your bale any size you want. If you're small and you can't handle a big bale, use a small one.
We don't recommend farming for you here.
No. We'll vote on it.
Let's see. Sweet potatoes. How many people grow sweet potatoes? They are fantastic. Most people like to eat sweet potatoes. Of course, like, and when it comes to survival, doesn't matter. When you get hungry, you'll eat it. But sweet potatoes are a powerhouse. And when I come to, you can look here, carbohydrate is right up there with most beans. Not quite wheat, but the nice thing, they contain some good vitamins. And they're sweet, so they add something that not many other storable crops would add to the diet. There's not, can you think of many other vegetables that are naturally sweet, store by themselves? Probably not. So, now sweet potatoes produce a lot in a small space. I don't have any figures with me on it, but they're right up there to the top as far as tons per space or pounds, whatever you've been growing. So sweet potatoes, I love them. Now, does anybody have an idea of how to grow a sweet potato? Right, it's a vine. And how do you get the vine?
From the tail.
Right. Then if you have a good sweet potato and leave it there, it will eventually start to grow. You could help it out by heat and moisture. In fact, commercially, they'll take the sweet potatoes and put them in a warm soil and get them to sprout. You don't plant the potato. Sweet potato, you don't plant the potato itself. You plant just a piece of that vine. And believe me, it'll strike out there on its own so fast. Just 2 or 3 days, and they seem to start to grow. So, one problem though, sweet potatoes that are commercially in the stores are usually treated with a sprout inhibitor. So they're difficult to get started. And they're also pretty expensive to buy the plants by mail order. I've seen priced 12 sprouts for $6, and that's outrageous to me. They're really a lot of profit there. So if you can make an experiment, and I've never really tried to sprout the ones from the store, but I seldom ever see them sprout like you would a white potato. You can get to see them sprouting all the time. I've grown my own since I bought sweet potatoes one time. Usually by the end of the winter, we're down to the little bitty ones, but they sprout and grow well, even on the size of a carrot. And we eat the big ones first. There's a problem with that, though. If you're going to save your sweet potatoes, you have to be careful that you don't accidentally select for a small size. You could accidentally do that. If you only ate the big ones, and the only thing that was left over were the small ones, you might accidentally be selecting year after year for smaller and smaller sweet potatoes. You don't want to do that. So really the best idea is to select a mother sweet potato or a bunch of them for the next year's crop. That'd probably be the best idea.
The size doesn't matter.
Of course. The larger they are, the more food, right?
So how do you save the potatoes for
the
next year?
Okay, I'll get to that later.
Okay.
For storing crops and preserving, I have a whole section on food preservation. Let's see. Anything else about sweet potatoes? Oh, and in harvesting sweet potatoes, don't wash them. they keep better if you don't wash them off. In fact, most all vegetables that are of a fresh nature that you're going to store fresh, it's better not to wash them. They seem to have a natural skin or a natural something on the outside that helps to preserve them in nature. When you wash that, you're not only scratching it. Sweet potatoes are very fragile coming out of the ground. You might have seen potatoes being dumped out in a dump truck. You can't do that with sweet potatoes. You really should take them in the field, put them into a box that they're going to be stored in, handled once and not anymore. Another thing about sweet potatoes, it's best to have a curing process which will partially dehydrate the skin and make it tougher. Because in long storage of sweet potatoes, the biggest problem is moisture loss. They'll lose the moisture and dry out. So what you want to do is toughen that skin. And there's different ways of doing it. What do you know about mold? Have you ever seen them cured or cured them yourself?
Not so much. We did a lot of that when I was younger, so I forgot about that.
Well, commercially, I've seen that some people will make them, cover them up. Generally, the conditions you want are about a week, 1 week at 80 degrees, and keep them dark, and a fairly good moisture. You don't want to bake them, and you don't want to completely dry them out, but you want to slowly toughen that skin is what you're trying to do. As far as storage, just to give you an idea, sweet potatoes need to be stored in a warmer place than regular white potatoes or Irish potatoes. Sweet potatoes are a long crop too. They'll run from 100 days is about the quickest one I found.
Could you store it in the basement, like an average 70 degrees somewhere in there? That's not a good storage temperature.
I believe I have a storage temperature in later, but if I don't, I'll tell you what I do. I keep them on the shelf in the house, and I think that's probably just as best as you can get. They, in other words, they probably like about the same temperature you like, but not any hotter. Split peas are about the same as beans, corn. I don't know. Does anybody have no idea how to deal with corn?
I don't grow it, but I never tried to save it.
Well, it's real easy. You just let it dry completely in the field. Now, notice that there's a difference between sweet corn and drying corn. Sweet corn is, if you've ever planted sweet corn, you'll see the seeds are all shriveled up, kind of flat and not much to them. That's because they're a different type of corn. Your grain corns fall into two categories. There's a flint and a dent. And if I can remember, there's popcorn. They're separate, they're different, and they're for different purposes. Your flint and dent are sort of interchangeable. They're both types of grinding corn. And by the way, white corn does not contain vitamin A. Yellow corn, and according to yellow corn does contain vitamin A. According to Michael Cottingham, red and blue corn, which is popular here in the Southwest, they contain vitamin A too, even though they're not yellow. Vitamin A generally is something that's yellow or orange or red. But blue corn has it, he says. Grinding corn, well, that's you just have to get a grinder, or, well, we saw Miles yesterday, you can rub the rocks together and nothing else.
So you dry it, and then how do you get the kernels off the hut?
Either completely by hand, they become pretty free on the husk. And you just turn it with your hands like this. Now, there's machines, nice machines that you can turn. And there's all kinds of grinders out there. I use a grinder. It's called a Vitamix. Some of you might have one. It's a super high speed blender, but it requires electricity, so I have to go on plan B if that fails. But the Vitamix is neat. You can grind any grain, spices. You can make the bread right in it if you want to. It'll knead it for you if you're lazy. So I guess that's about all I had to say about this, unless y'all have some more questions. It's bound to be something.
Would you want the Vitamix seat in the area in which you live so it would be more hard to your time? Or would it, you know what I'm saying?
The question is, do you need to have seeds that are suitable for your area? And that's for sure. If you look in the better seed catalogs, they will tell you what area they're best for, especially corn, I noticed. But the suggestion I have for you as far as selection is to talk to the old timers, people that do it in your area, your county extension office, which is is between a state agriculture agency and usually connected to research at the state universities. Those people are trained to do this, they're paid to do this, and you might as well make something out of the taxes you've been paying.
Do you recommend retailers?
Yeah, I sure do. I'll get to food preservation, a whole section on that later on. But what you want to look for is in choosing a variety, you want to have something, number one, that is high yielding. Of course, the more you yield you got for the amount of land and the effort, the better. You want it to be adapted to your area. Some varieties need less inputs, like some will grow on less fertilizer, less water. Some are more susceptible to insects, some are less. It's a pretty hard choice, but if you go by what the most successful people in your area are doing, you'll come out pretty good. The soil can be variable, though. If a fellow a mile away has a different soil than you, that might not be the right choice. So the extension agency can also help you if they do free soil testing. And that's a must. You've got to test your soil. You really do. And so make use of them for your advice. But the old timers, if you can make a friend of an experienced gardener, you're halfway there. Yes, Bill?
I think the question is really, you have to understand what the situation is going to be. If you're just planning for a situation where there's never going to be a breakdown of the societal infrastructure or your ability to shift things from one point to another, all of that is well and good. But if the shit hits the fan, which I sincerely believe is going to happen, the seeds you bought yesterday are the last seeds you're ever going to buy from anybody. So you need to have open pollinated seeds, and you have to be able to not only know which seeds to plant when and in what soil and which ones of those seeds are going to grow in your area, but you have to know when those plants are grown, how to harvest a certain amount of those seeds so that you can have a crop the following year. So, all this stuff about seeds, if you don't have that foremost in your mind, no matter what you know about all this other stuff, it's not going to make any difference. And Jay's going to cover, as he said, open pollinating seeds later. But I think that is the most important thing for you to learn if you're going to be growing your own garden and your own crops, is how to get those seeds, which ones to get for your area, what soil to plant them in, and how to harvest the seeds at the end of the growing season so that you have a crop the following year. If you can't do that, your garden is over after that next crop.
Well, on along that line, Bill, I had never until a couple of days ago looked at one of these prepackaged long-term storage seed cans, and I looked at it, and they had some pretty good choices that are probably generally good to grow anywhere. But if you have a special condition, they might not be the thing to have. You might really be better off selecting your own seeds for your area. I was thinking what would be an example, Alaska. Those people have to have some special seeds. They have to be special. And what I saw in there probably wouldn't work in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got a letter from a friend of hers a week or so ago that Quinton was trying to put into legislation sterilization of all seeds.
Yeah, the latest I heard on that line is a genetic process of manipulating the genes within a seed so that it will absolutely not germinate in a second generation. You cannot save that seed genetically. It will not. It's programmed to never be reproduced, which is an idea to control that you have to go back to that seed company all the time.
Yeah. It's not just the seed company. The whole object is controlled. The object is that there will not ever be a self-sufficient population that has to be submitted to the control of where the government is in charge. That's the real purpose of that kind of science.
I will say one thing, though. If I was going to save seeds, I do save seeds. I usually, right now, I buy my seeds for the next year. I buy seeds ahead for the next year, way before they put them away or whatever they might do. But I will say that there's a lot to be said for hybrid seeds. There's no question that, in general, they yield higher. So how about this idea? You always keep a year's supply of hybrid seeds for your first crop. You always keep another year's supply of your open pollinated seeds for that backup. If you feel you won't ever get a chance to buy seeds again, or they'll be limited, that way. You might be able to get more yield because their hybrids will yield more, almost any case, if they're suited for the right area. There's been cases where they sent to some third world country, they sent a hybrid seed saying, look what it did here in the U.S., and it just didn't suit their area, so it was really worse than what they had before. But if you get the right hybrid, I'll think of an example is peppers. It's hard to beat some of the hybrid peppers. They're so much better than, in some cases, than the open pollinated peppers. And that's just one example. They really do. They're made for that. They're made. The process of a hybrid. I'll go into that a little bit. A hybrid seed is taking one plant with one characteristic and another plant with another characteristic, and when you cross-pollinate one to the other, that's taking pollen from one, putting it into the female part of another. That's the process of cross-pollinating. When you mix those, cross those two, you can get the best of both. That's the aim. Like if you had a plant that had a good quality of color or taste, and you had another one that had a very vigorous growth, neither one of them had both qualities. When you combine the two, you get one with good taste and good growth. So that's the purpose behind hybrid. And also, for some reason, almost invariably, when you cross different strains or genes, you'll get an improvement. For some reason, that's almost always true. There are some purebred with, even for animals, that's even true in a lot of cases. So,
Why don't they produce seeds again, though?
Okay. They will produce seeds. I'll qualify that. There's different types of hybrids, and it gets pretty deep genetics. But what will happen is, after the first generation, you don't know what you're going to get because it becomes mixed up. You might get a plant that's as good, or it might revert back to one of the other parents, or it might be worse than both parents. So you're throwing dice, for instance. And in some types of hybrids, and I won't get into it because it's very hard to explain, but in some types of hybrids, they're sterile anyway. So, like a mule, for instance.
Yeah.
In some cases, they are. Most of the time, they will grow. And so, if you had no other choice, I would even go ahead and save hybrid seeds if I had no other choice. Because most cases, you'll get something. So, all is not lost. I guess God put something in those seeds that makes them want to grow. They may not be exactly what you want. Who knows? There's a chance that you could get something better. A lot of the improvements were made by accident. The Red Delicious apple, that was what they call a sport. Somebody planted the seeds, it grew up, and it was a Red Delicious apple. And they take a branch, they took a branch from that mama tree, and the guy got big bucks for that tree. And then they grafted on it and produced them by the billions.
Have you ever heard of the ARC Institute? It's out of Maryland. And
ARK?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
I think it's got a web page. And she will, for 90 bucks, the lady that's in charge of it, will print up to your area, tailored for your area and your soil and your climate, all the kinds of seeds that you should buy that will do well in your locale. And she's got a book on self-sufficiency, and she put me in touch with the Seed Savers of America.
Yeah, I have heard of them and dealt with them before.
And we're down to 15% of our seeds are now open pollinated, but 85% are hybrid, and it's diminishing rapidly around the world.
Yeah, it's a neat idea. And what you say is true, that now they speak of that we've lost a lot. And in some cases we have, but there's things that have been lost that have been found again. One person saved that, and from then on it could be reproduced.
You know they advertise those,
if
you're
drinking Bushy,
you get a can.
Yeah, I saw one.
Somebody said that those are fleshy sprouts, that when you put seeds and beans and whatnot, you know, live things in a vacuum with nitrogen, it kills the seeds. So
I tell you, I question that too. I really do. I know that seed is alive. It is actually a living thing. It's slowly dying, but it's alive.
Have to breathe, and they take all the air out, or when you put nitrogen in it, the seeds can't breathe, so then they...
Yeah, I don't know if I noticed. I don't think... Well, Jack has one. Does it say the length? Does it actually state the length of storage?
It's supposed to be good for about 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
The packings, seeds are packaged individually, and then the nitrogen part in this container.
But they still can't breathe.
Yeah, I really can't answer that. And one other thing I noticed, it looked like, I didn't open the package, but just from my experience of knowing how much seed, it seemed skimpy for the area that they said it would plant. And I would double it if I was planning on planting a, if they said it was, would plant one size garden, I would probably have two cans on hand, because seeds will tend to lose their viability, and they won't all germinate, but some will. So you're safer the better the more you have.
How about are you using the pest control?
A little bit, Well, I guess unless anybody has any more questions, we'll go on to the next.
Is it better to keep them in a refrigerator or freeze or something if you're going to hold them long term?
Well, if you have a refrigeration, that's best. Keep them up. And I think I have something on that later, seed saving, written down for you. But one thing that seeds do like is constant temperature. If you can't keep them frozen or, and freezing won't hurt them generally, if you can't keep them frozen or cool, at least keep them constant. That's better.
This Ark Institute recommends that you save your seeds, that you desiccate them, you dry them, get some of the desiccant that comes in the vitamin pill bottles or whatever, put them in mason jars, and then put them in a freezer, and they'll stay good for viable for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. I do know that I save seeds in the freezer, and it doesn't hurt them at all.
You like bananas?
They can be a big help, for especially for an early start.
And, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, that's it for tonight. So, tune in tomorrow, and we will continue with Jay Reynolds' wonderful, outstanding lecture on gardening and farming and seeds and storing your crops and how to plant them and take care of it and make compost piles and all that kind of stuff. He's just begun. You have no idea the tremendous depth of this subject that he's going to cover. So, don't miss it.
And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance, and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver with every paper I deliver. Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride. Something touched me deep inside the day the music died. So bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And then good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. Did you write the book of love? And did you have faith in God above? Is the Bible there in the song? Have you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul? And can you teach me how to dance real slow? Well, I know that you're in love with him, 'cause I saw you dancing him. You both kicked off your shoes. Then I dig those rhythmic blues. That was a lonely teenage frunk and buck with a pink carnation and a pickup truck. But I knew I was out of luck the day the music died. I started singing bye bye Miss American Pie.
You've been listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, for your information, 101.1 FM Eager will cease broadcasting 1 week from today.